Emery Douglas is an American graphic artist and member of the Black Panther Party in the United States from 1967 until the party disbanded in the 1980s. As a revolutionary artist and the Minister of Culture for the Black Panthers, Douglas created iconography to represent Black American oppression. His work became symbolic of the movement, and he continues to create new art and to exhibit and lecture around the world under normal circumstances. And indeed, he has been working with the Polynesian Panthers on their 25th anniversary celebrations this year. And he's going to collaborate on painting a mural to celebrate the links between the organisations as part of the Auckland Arts Festival. Details of that on our webpage. And he joins us from San Francisco. Hello.
Hello.
So you're going to come all the way over here and go into quarantine, are you?
No, I'll be here. I won't be traveling.
Oh, you're staying there and doing it long distance.
Yes.
That's probably the wisest move. I wanted to ask... I wanted to ask you, Emery, what you think of... There's been quite a flood of portrayals of the Black Panthers. A couple of movies, for example, the Netflix movie, The Trial of the Chicago Seven, and also Judas and the Black Messiah. I wanted to ask you what you thought of the portrayal all these years later.
Well, I think because you're dealing with Hollywood, so you got a Hollywood portrayal. In that context, you may get some relevancy out of it, but you understand that those films always have to be have to go through review. And when they go through review, that means that they decide on how they want to portray it, or it doesn't get the kind of credits that it should get in ratings, or it might possibly be delayed released to the public. So you got those dynamics that you're dealing with anytime that you, it's like Huey Newton used to say, power is the ability to define phenomena and make it act in a desired manner. So the most of those and who are these young artists, writers and producers may have some impact, but they don't have the power. Hollywood still has the power to decide and determine how the movies are going to be shaped.
Sure. So you're saying that it's a misrepresentation?
There's a lack of proper representation. Facts are there in those movies. I'm quite sure the young directors and the producers may have wanted to go further than what they've gone, but of course their hands are tied in many ways in the context of the system itself. So it's a matter of how Hollywood sees that the movie is going to be marketed, because they're talking about making money and it's about profit making. That don't mean that they don't have good intentions. It just means that that's the reality that exists. There are things, for example, the Mario Van Peebles movie, The Panther Party. That movie had a high budget of over $50 million. But when it came down to the final cuts, when they showed them the final things that they want to include in the film, it went all the way down to $15 million. So therefore, they had to force them to have to eliminate many things in the movie, you see. So those dynamics come into play in making those films.
I read one critic...
That doesn't mean that it has to have any substance or relevancy to those who are concerned about what's going on and when it took place. It doesn't mean that they didn't touch on some of the highlights, some of the reality that the Panthers were about, or the repression that was taking place against the Panthers, but is very limited and sometimes the out of context.
I read one critic, Emery, that said that certainly that the movie Judas and the Black Messiah, about Fred Hampton, basically, did not describe fully his Marxist anti-capitalist politics. Is that what you're referring to when things, you know, are left on the cutting room floor when it comes to Hollywood?
What I'm referring to is the fact that what I'm referring to is how they played up the agent provocateur who infiltrated the party.
Yeah.
They started off with him at the beginning.
This is Bill O'Neill, yeah?
It was more about that than it was about Fred Hampton.
Yeah. Which, I mean, I suppose that's a matter of emphasis. Fred Hampton, of course, is mentioned in The Trial of the Chicago Seven when Bobby Seale is told that Fred Hampton has been killed, shot by the FBI. Did you know Fred Hampton?
Yes, I knew Fred Hampton. I met him several times when I was back. I've been to Chicago about four or five times. And on several occasions, when he wasn't busy, he came through and met with Fred. And when he came out, he came to California as well at one point, and met him when he came out to Oakland, California. Mm-hmm.
Did he completely get bamboozled, sucked in by the FBI informant Bill O'Neill?
Well, Fred Hampton was a charismatic 21-year-old who had been involved since he was 13-year-old with freedom movements, social justice movements. He was in the NAACP prior as a young person, as well as other organizations. He was a leader who was being able to galvanize other youngsters to come in and to become more politicized in what they were doing. And so all that dynamics played into why Fred Hampton was murdered. You know, it was Fred Hampton was transforming the mindset. You have to understand, this is a time when you're dealing with the politics of the daily machine in Chicago. That's the machine the same way was torturing and brutalizing, murdering people. Chicago is, was the location when Dr. King was passing through and got stabbed, I believe, in the march. You know, in Chicago, you were dealing with the most extreme, going north, you could say, of bigotry and institutional racism that exists at that time. So Fred Hampton was a victim of the COINTELPRO program to destroy and discredit the Black Panther Party by any means necessary.
When you think back on that time, Emery, how many FBI informants, how many people did the FBI insert into the Black Panthers, do you think?
Well, we don't know because it don't make it public. You know, you find out here, you find out there every now and then that existed, you know, but you don't know who they were, you know. You can't get the only way you can get those documents is if you get them you get the documents, it's all blacked out, so you don't know what's going on. Unless you got a case like, for example, Geronimo Gijaga, who was the Panther, who was set up in Los Angeles, California. And it was finally found out through Johnny Cochran, which was our lawyer and had already been a lawyer for many, many years in Los Angeles for the Black Panther Party. When he was able to get the documents that were redacted to show that this was the same Panther who was accusing him of the murder was the same one that set him out. So it all that came out, and he was an informant before the Black Panther Party. So you don't, so these kinds of documents you don't come across unless you have some kind of legal way to press, or your lawyers can get access of the documents that's redacted. So you can say that that was a part of the limitations of the Black Panther Party, and that was because the intern was able to exploit our limitations as a youth movement internally because of causing all this chaos from time to time that took place.
We were talking earlier in the program about, you know, the famous quote, the arc of the universe, the arc of the moral universe bends towards justice. And I was thinking of that in the context of the catalyst for the formation of the Black Panthers was the death of an unarmed boy, a 16-year-old, killed by the police in San Francisco. And we've seen this again being the catalyst for the formation of the Black Lives Matter. The arc of the moral universe doesn't seem to be bending that much, does it?
Well, no, not long, not, no, unless you, you create a new universe, one that's in the interest and spirit of compassion and understanding and quality of life issues. As long as you have corruption, exploitation, and you have the exploiting class and those who could care less because they have theirs, and then this is going to continue. This is continuation.
Would you still describe yourself as a Marxist and an anti-capitalist?
Well, I define myself as a humanist. Human concerns, quality of life. Irregardless of the ism, if it ain't working, it ain't working.
So when you joined the Black Panthers, what did you hope to achieve?
Well, we had a 10-point platform and program that we had that we wanted power to just determine our poor and oppressed communities. We talked about the wanting full employment for the people. We wanted to end of the robbery by the capitalists of our Black community. So these were issues that we were concerned with. We wanted education for our people that gave us our true history, and you know, it exposed us the true nature of this decadent American society. We wanted to teach us our history of our role in present day society. We wanted Black men to be exempt from the military service. We wanted immediate end of police brutality and murder of Black people. We wanted freedom for all Black men held in federal, state, county, city, prisons, and jails. And we wanted Black people, when brought to trial, to be tried by a jury of their peers or people from the Black community, as it was defined by the Constitution. We said defined by the Constitution, but that was an error because it doesn't say that defined like that in the Constitution. So we wanted land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, and peace.
One of the things that is not pointed out so much in actually either of the movies I've seen that I just cited is your community activism and your aid, which, as somebody said, was less recognized these days anyway than the guns and the leather coats.
Say that again, please. I heard the last part, but I didn't hear the other part.
One of the things that is not remembered so much about the Black Panthers is the community activism and the aid.
Mm-hmm.
You were involved in that. Did you go on those patrols with Huey Newton and Bobby Seale?
Yes, I did go on patrols when I was came into the organization. And when I initially went on the patrols, because they had already been experienced, they said you go as an observer in the initial phase, because we've already been training for this. And it was not going in to intimidate or anything. I was exercising the right, the Second Amendment of the Constitution, to give the right to bear arms. Huey Newton and Bobby Seale had studied this, understood the law. They had access to law books. So the patrols were going to out to observe the profiling and harassment of young blacks in the neighborhood who were being stopped strictly because of the color who they were, and explaining to them, standing illegal distance away from the police, which was about 6 feet to 10 feet away, explaining to those who were being harassed and arrested that they had the right to stay silent, or they could give their name, address, and phone number. And if they were arrested, that we would come and try to bail them out. And on many cases, we did bail them out. See, the whole idea of the guns and what have you was a part of one of the programs, initial program, and why it started at point number 7 of the 10-point platform program was because of the many, over 200 rebellions took place in the United States in the 1960s because of police murders of young blacks and the many rebellions that took place because of that, as you've seen recently. And because of that, it was an urgency at that time to start around point number 7, wanting immediate end to police brutality and murder of black people. So that's how the patrols came about in that context. We never went into invaded the Capitol. We were invited into the Capitol in Sacramento with the press leading the way to go trying to find the chambers where they were trying to, you had this right-wing assemblyman who they got to change the local gun ordinances, because now the blacks were carrying guns just like the whites were, but in the context of not for the same reason. But now you had the audacity to implement laws that were made for racist white people, and black people are now implementing and doing it and exercising their right, this constitutional right. Now it becomes a crime, a criminal, an act of criminalized, because the fact that you're going on the patrols, you know the law, you articulated that you have to the police that you have a right to be here, and that you're not breaking any law. Therefore, they become frustrated. Therefore, they get these right-wing assemblymen to change the local gun ordinance, so it becomes a violation in relationship to the local gun ordinance to carry guns and what have you. So it's the institutional racism that continues out of that context in relationship to the local gun law and what have you. And mind you, when Sacramento, it was men and women who weren't a part of that delegation. You don't see but men, but it was men and women. There were Panthers and non-Panthers who were part of that delegation. You don't see that. They never talk about that.
Do you think that the Black Lives Matter movement is a continuation of the Black Panthers' views, or is it a completely different kind of thing?
Well, this is young people who have been inspired by and inspired with what the Black Panther Party was about. But at the same way, it's a continuation in the context of exists today. But when you talk about Black Lives Matter, you can go all the way back to slavery to talk about Black Lives Matter. They've coined the word in a way that is so powerful today and have meaning to them, because it's black people who are being repressed and being denied. So the impact of it today, and it's certainly been an inspiration or been inspired by the Black Panther Party and being in spirit with what we were about. And I have been invited to many Black Lives Matter talks, UCLA, on the universities, and various talk to other Black Lives Matter artists about political art and doing political art. So there is a link there, a connection between the Black Panther Party and Black Lives Matter. But they coined the word, just like we coined the word, all power to the people. That means the same thing. All power to the people was a powerful slogan of the Black Panther Party, which is Black Lives Matter, is represents all power to the people. Black lives matter because all lives matter. All lives matter because black lives matter.
What happened to the Black Panthers in the end, Emery?
Pardon me?
What happened to the Black Panthers in the end?
What happened to the Black Panthers in the end? Well, the spirit of the Black Panther continues. So the spirit of it lives on. But the actual organization doesn't exist anymore.
Well, that's right, but why? What happened?
What happened because of the fact of what they done, they misinformation, the lies, the distortion, the intimidation, the threats that they put out, and claiming that the free breakfast program that we had was an internal threat to the security of the United States government, threatening vendors who were donating to those programs, going in having setting up Asian provocateurs who were dressed like Panthers, going into venues, having them robbing and stealing and telling them, vendors, that they weren't donating enough to the programs. And they coming to us, telling us, and believing that we did it, and they're getting these fake letters on Panther stationery. And Bobby Seale's trying to tell them, no, that's not us, that's the police. But they're shaking and they believe in this information. So it's the misinformation program that played a great part. And the attacks, and now we're defending ourselves in those attacks across the country. All that played into the demise of the Black Panther Party in that context. But as you see today, you have many, many people still talking about the need. There's a need for the Black Panther Party.
Do you ever wonder?
What you represent.
Do you ever wonder what would have happened back in your day if you'd had camera phones? Phone cameras?
Yeah. Well, I think that they would have tried to do as they do today, try to justify that, well, you can't tell from the camera, and, you know, you got to wait and see, to delay the process until they can get their lives together, stores together, you know. You got one of the most powerful unions in this country is the police union. And it's extreme to the right. They're the ones who give them time to set up and find something you might have spit on the street when you was a two-year-old and try to say you spit it on the street, so therefore that make you a criminal now in the context of whatever they're trying to justify against you.
It's very good to talk to you. Are you in good health, Emery, in these times?
Yes. I try to eat a good diet. You know, I'm a vegan. For myself, I don't drink, all those things. So I try to do a little stretch and yoga when I can. You know? So I work at it. It's a job, but I work at it.
Will you stay clear of COVID, please?
Huh?
Stay well and look forward to your collaboration long distance with the Polynesian Panthers. Thank you. Emery Douglas, who was the Black Panther Minister of Culture and revolutionary artist back in the 60s and the 70s.